Auto insurance can all seem the same until it comes time to use it. So don't get stuck paying more for less coverage. Switch to USAA Auto Insurance and you could start saving money in no time. Get a quote today. Restrictions apply.
If you went on a road trip and you didn't stop for a Big Mac or drop a crispy fry between the car seats or use your McDonald's bag as a placemat, then that wasn't a road trip. It was just a really long drive. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
At participating McDonald's.
Two guys drove to work. Neither guy wore a seatbelt. One guy got a ticket. One guy didn't. The same two guys drove home. One guy wore a seatbelt. One guy didn't. One guy made it home. The guy not wearing his seatbelt didn't. Don't risk it. Click it or ticket. Paid for by NHTSA.
This is the Ridiculous Ashes podcast. I'm Dan Libke. With me is Alex Burden.
Hello.
We're covering historical Ashes series to find out which nation is the more ridiculous at cricket, England or Australia. And the series we've been covering this time around is the 2013-14 Ashes, which is just about to draw to a conclusion.
Okay. The way it works is I nominate England's most ridiculous moments from each test match. And Dan nominates Australia's most ridiculous moments from each test match. And then we pick our top three and give them 3-2-1 points to see who won the ridiculous test. England have actually already secured the ridiculous Ashes as a 3-1 up. 3-1 up with this final test to play. The fourth test match was... they won that largely through the 3-2-1 nonsense dismissals in their first innings. Three ridiculous dismissals, the finest of which was Monty Panesar leaving a ball that could not have missed his stumps by any sort of geometry or freakishness of physics. There was no way he was missing his stumps, but he left it anyway. 2 points was for Nathan Coulter-Nile's acrobatic fielding on the boundary that resulted in him hurling the ball behind his back for six. But then the clincher was Graham Swan retiring before the match and everyone being very, very angry about it for quite a long time. Probably still now. So what happened in the fifth test match then, the Sydney test then?
All right, the Sydney test. Australia was sent into bat and they reached 326. They recovered from 5 for 97 thanks to a century partnership between Brad Haddin and centurion Steve Smith. Ben Stokes actually took his maiden 5-wicket haul in test cricket during this innings. He finished with 6 for 99. In reply, England collapsed to 5 for 23 before they had a little bit of a mini recovery to reach 155. Thanks to Stuart Broad, who scored 30 from 22 balls, and he saw his side pass the follow-on target. Australia then kind of just went on a bit of a clattering spree. They raced to 276 in 61 overs, anchored by a century from Chris Rogers, which meant England needed 448 for victory. Instead, they were bowled out for 166 to give Australia a 5-0 clean sweep of the series. All right, so I think I'll start these nominations, if that's okay.
Okay, yeah, sure.
I'm going to start with Australia selecting an unchanged team for the entire series.
Ah, yeah.
Australia had 11 players. In fact, they had the same 12th man for each match as well. So they had an unchanged 12 for the entire series, but an unchanged 11 on the field, which in a sense you don't think that's completely ridiculous considering it's a 5-0 win. Teams tend not to change winning sides that often. But in itself, the 5-0 win is very ridiculous. This is not a side that should be winning 5-0. They've just lost a series 3-0 to and with essentially the same side. The batters did essentially nothing, as I mentioned in the previous match. The average score at the loss of the fifth wicket for Australia was 142. That's not the foundation of a clean sweep. In particular, George Bailey was carried along for the final couple of tests pretty much so they could just say they stuck with the same team throughout. I don't think he was there for any other reason. He was not pulling his weight in any sense.
Except for that one over. He did all right, that one over.
Yes, he did. He was dropped for the next series against South Africa, which meant he finished with a 5-0 career in test cricket, which is very good. In fact, I crunched some numbers and there are a handful of cricketers who have a 100% win record for a test career of five matches. matches or more. Three of them have five. That's Bailey, Ken Archer, who was an Australian off-spinner in the 1950s, and Lord Hawke, who is a fantastically named English cricketer of the 1890s. Then there's also Kyle Jamieson, the New Zealand fast-medium bowler, who has six at the time we recorded this before recent results removed him from the list. And then there's the Bradman of win-loss ratios. That's the magnificent Eldeen Baptiste of the 1980s West Indies, who has 10 wins, zero draws, zero losses, zero ties. I think that's impossible to beat. But George Bailey got halfway there. And I guess the other kind of, you know, ridiculous aspect of this 5-0 unchanged team was that Ryan Harris survived an entire series without further knee damage that ruled him out of a match. And that's kind of a minor miracle. I think that the 12th man, James Faulkner, must have been very surprised that he was stuck with dozeneering duties for all five tests.
I was about to ask who was 12th man for all those tests, because I obviously have no recollection of it. James Faulkner.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I said earlier in the series that they were a funny sort of side. The top order batting was pretty ineffectual.
Yep.
And then, you know, Ryan Harris, you would only ever consider a sort of temporary part-time fill-in bowler, despite his quality, like probably the best bowler on either side. But in terms of his physique, you wouldn't really sort of bank on him playing more than two or three tests in a five-test series ordinarily.
Yep.
Yeah, there were a whole load of oddities, so to actually stick with them for five tests was quite something. If I can give a counter nomination to yep. Australia selecting an unchanged team, I would like to nominate England selecting a changed team, yep. as they so often seem to do in the fifth test of series. But I feel like this was a particularly fine example of picking a changed team. They gave test debuts to three players, Gary Balance, Scott Borthwick and Boyd Rankin. Of these, Boyd Rankin was also playing his final test, as it turned out, although he did play another one against them not so long ago. And I would say the odds are currently against Scott Borthwick playing another, certainly as a leg spinner. He's currently playing as a batsman for Durham. It did go particularly well for them, it has to be said. Boyd Rankin went off with cramp twice on day one, so that was an excellent start.
I always thought of Boyd Rankin as a Rancor from Return of the Jedi. That was mostly just based on his name, but he wasn't entirely physically dissimilar. He's got the, kind of this huge hulking creature. But yeah, I'm not quite sure how he got cramped twice on the first day that he played Test cricket.
Yeah, I think it was only alongside Chris Tremlett, who looked even more like a Rancor.
Yes.
With his he had the mouth for it. You could see him crushing a steel gate with those jaws.
Yeah.
I think he got cramped twice on day one because he'd basically not been playing cricket for quite a long time. He'd played a couple of the warm-up matches and then he'd just been sat around watching England get hammered for the rest of the time. And possibly getting hammered himself. I don't know how he did this time. Borthwick had a pretty ordinary match as well. He returned 1 for 49 off 7 overs in the first innings and 3 for 33 off 6 in the second, and he made 1 run and 4 runs.
Right.
He'd been called up when Graham Swan went home, when Graham Swan had retired, and he'd been playing grade cricket, including one match alongside Brad Haddin. Borthwick said that Haddin was a good fella, and Haddin said that Borthwick would be monstered when he played against him. So I don't know what their relationship was like.
That's a perfect Haddin response, I think. I expect nothing less from Brad Haddin to respond like that to a bit of praise from an Englishman. Yeah, in the end, Borthwick did get 2 wickets with the full toss in the second innings. He did get Haddin out. He lobbed a full toss to Haddin, who managed to just hit it to a fielder, and he also got Ryan Harris with a full toss. So Borthwick had some deliveries up his sleeve.
Well, yeah, so there's a disclaimer to that. The 3 for 33, which is clearly his biggest contribution to the match. 3 for 33 of 6 overs, 2 wickets with full tosses, which is
Yes. Well, I'll move on to my next nomination, if you like, because it kind of segues nicely from Borthwick into Steve Smith, and in particular Steve Smith's baggy green. Because Smith took a bit of a liking to poor old Borthwick. I think he recognised, he was like looking in a mirror, he recognised the leg spin filth of Borthwick and said, I know how this works. This is rubbish. I'm just going to hammer about this everywhere. And that's pretty much what he did. He brought up his century with a 6 and a 4 from Borthwick in the one over. And the latter was from a rank full toss, which he just clobbered into the outfield for...
The wicket-taking delivery, ordinarily. Yes.
Smith failed to fall for that trap. And for the most part, like a little bit of hindsight corner here, we started to see the ridiculous shots of Smith that we know now, where he just kind of jumps at the ball outside off stump and somehow plays these bizarre shots to the boundary. Prior to this innings, he'd mostly looked like a normal earthling creature. He'd batted well, but not in a kind of over-the-top ridiculous fashion. This was far more in the eccentric fashion that we've come to know from Steve Smith.
Yeah.
It was also his 300 against England in 6 matches, which, again, in hindsight corner, that this may be establishing an ominous trend for England in terms of Steve Smith.
Well, that's quite... That's a career for plenty of people. Three hundreds in Ashes tests is quite the record, really. So at this point, we're saying he's barely even established. We don't really... lots of things are becoming familiar to us, and he's already made 3 test hundreds against England.
Yeah, but I was more startled to see a post-match interview where he is wearing a baggy green cap, and it was at least 3 sizes too big for him. It was a massive thing. It was basically falling onto the front of his face. So I've called that Steve Smith's baggy green, and that's my nomination.
Yeah, I haven't seen it. I can only sort of imagine. Was it over his ears? Was it just that it wouldn't stay on his head, or was it actually just sort of enveloping him? Was he?
I think we later discovered that both. I think Cameron Bancroft famously had a heavy head that Western Australia had somehow weighed, and Mitch Marsh. So maybe he had Mitch Marsh's baggy. I'm not sure either of those players had a baggy green at this stage. Cameron Bancroft certainly didn't. So, but he must have borrowed it off somebody, because it's just monstrously big. Maybe they thought he would grow into it. I'm not quite sure what was going on there.
Unless he was suffering such acute dehydration that he was actually physically shriveling, and even his skull was retracting, and his hat was maintaining its size.
He does have a smaller than average head, I believe, because I vividly recall there was a photo of him and Darren Lehman after they won the Ashes one time as captain and coach. And, I mean, Darren Lehman has a massive head.
Well, I was about to say, I'm not sure you've made a comparison error there, that it might just be contextual.
But in this photo that I can still picture, Lehman's head looks like twice as big as Smith's. So I think it's a case of Lehman having a massive head and Smith having a very small head. And perhaps they just mixed up their baggy greens. Perhaps Lehman brought his baggy green along to wear around at the end of the match.
There's a famous in my circles photograph of James Taylor, who used to play for England. Unfortunately retired early, batting alongside teammate Will Jefferson. And Taylor's about the smallest batsman you're ever likely to find, and Will Jefferson is about the largest giant you're ever likely to find. It's just an absolute wonderful contrast of them, sort of dads v lads kind of cricket.
Yeah,
brings that to mind, the head comparison. Right, can I move on to my next nomination, or have you any more hats?
No, I don't have any further chat on the baggy green.
Right, we'll move to a different piece of equipment now, because my nomination is Mike Carberry's bat. So I'll talk you through what happened here. Ryan Harris is bowling, bowls the ball. Mike Carberry defends. Mike Carberry's bat snaps in half. That's what happened. And when I say in half, I mean properly in half, so that the bottom bit ended up hanging by the bat sticker.
Yes.
So how do bats break typically? Either the handle comes off or a chunk comes off the toe. Those are the two main ways that bats break, isn't it?
Yeah.
Mike Carberry's bat snapped in the middle, like square across the blade. It was the weirdest thing you've ever seen. As he plays the shot, the bottom half of the bat flaps forwards like it wants to try and hit a 6, and the top half didn't. That's how I'd describe it.
So he was trying to hit a 3, perhaps.
Yeah. And then, obviously, the players do that thing where cricketers have to react to something visually. So they have to become sort of mimes, essentially. So Carberry and Harris do some sort of comic face acting. George Bailey wandered in and he grabbed the bat to have a look at the snap. Carberry sort of dangles it like a fetid dead animal, and then he chucks it and does this exaggerated hands on hips dissatisfied thing. It was all very, very wonderful. Like, the whole reaction to it is like a little bit awkward and pantomime.
Yeah.
But the snapping of a bat so squarely across in such an innocuous delivery, that's my nomination.
Yeah, it's very good. I particularly like in commentary, you can hear Mark Nicholas greet the moment, as he so often does. He's like, "Hello." And then he goes on to add that other than the winning moment of the Ashes, that's the image of the summer. Which I know Mark Nicholas likes his hyperbole, but I'm not quite sure that's true. I also liked Brad Haddon's reaction, of course. Brad Haddon, what did he say about Borthwick? He'd monster Borthwick. He piped in. You could hear this on the stump mic from the match. He piped in. He says, "It's a Grey Nichols, fellas. He's just got stickers on it. It's not a kookaburra, it's just a Grey Nichols." So Brad Haddon is now sledging bat manufacturers.
He's going to be bat loyal.
Yes. And I guess the other thing I like about this one is that Carberry still managed to top score for the innings, which is very impressive with the broken bat. It kind of reminded me, Glenn Maxwell actually similarly broke a bat against India a few years later on the first ball of the second day of a test. And then he went on to make his only test century so far, of course.
It's delightful.
Yep. So yeah, so maybe breaking your bat is a key to batting success.
It's a sign of good luck. Okay, yeah. Across the path.
Yeah. And just as a side, of course, it is criminal that Glenn Maxwell has never played an Ashes Test match, and so this is probably the only time he's ever going to be mentioned in this series.
Possibly. We can but dream.
All right. I'll go on to my third and final nomination, and this one only comes to light at the end of the match, and it's the end of the series, really. It's that Nathan Lyon finished the series with no average. Nathan Lyon was undismissible in this test series. He came out to bat on 6 occasions. He scored 60 runs, and not once was he dismissed, which basically meant that if he'd been given the opportunity to bat one more time and scored as few as 2 runs before being dismissed, he would have had an average of 62, which would have seen him go past Brad Haddon's 61.62 to top the series batting averages for both sides. And I put it to you that is highly ridiculous.
Yeah, if I was actually slagging off Nathan Lyon's batting aptitude earlier in the series, and now you throw this at me. I think if you dwell on that, that is quite a deeply ridiculous moment. A batting average of 60, I mean, you didn't attain a batting average because you didn't bother getting dismissed, but an average of 60 would be more than double what any England player managed in the series, apart from Ben Stokes, who was only 34 or something like that, but everybody else was under 30, so they could have, I don't know, hired Nathan Lyon and borrowed him as a specialist batsman and improved their side. Right, we'll move on. Should we move on to my final nomination?
Yes, which indeed.
In a sense, is the biggie, which I've kept my powder dry on this one for a while, because I could only nominate it once. Mm. It's Kevin Peterson not speaking to the England coach, generally falling out with everyone, and then getting sacked despite being excellent at cricket.
Yeah.
Which we've conspicuously not mentioned throughout this series, despite the fact it's been bubbling away. But we didn't really know too much about it until this point. This is where everything suddenly came to a head and all the stuff that had been happening previously started leaking out.
Yes.
So the way it happened was that after the series, the ECB, the England Wales Cricket Board, sacked Kevin Peterson. Initially, they said the management team had concluded they were better off without him and that they would be providing no further details, which I thought, which was an element of hindsight corner here. I don't even know if hindsight corner applies here or whether we felt this at the time. That was a bit optimistic.
Yes.
Countless statements and leaks followed, often sort of delayed by legal advice. It was all very preposterously overblown. One of the statements famously said that they weren't happy with the criticism of their decision from people outside cricket.
Yes.
And then a bit of the reasoning did start coming out. They implied it was because he didn't support Alistair Cook, which I think, as we know, is probably fair enough. Mm-hmm. And then leaked documents listed various Peterson crimes. These included taking younger teammates out drinking when they've been told to not go out drinking, mm-hmm. staring out of windows, checking his watch, and whistling after being dismissed. He's also supposed to have told a physio that if England lost the third test, his knee was really going to be playing up. But the reason why it's being nominated now at the fifth test is because Andy Flower, the coach, apparently didn't speak to Peterson for the whole of this test or the rest of the tour after KP ranted at him following the fourth test. I think he went to his hotel room and gave him a mouthful. And these sort of ins and outs of this are all a bit muddy, but I think that the players had organized a team meeting because they felt like Andy Flower was maybe oppressing them a bit and holding them back by just being such a harsh Andy Flower taskmaster type.
By being Andy Flower.
They'd reached the limit of what they could sort of bear of Andy Flower. And then I don't know if Kevin Peterson had taken it upon himself to be the sort of spokesperson or he'd sort of like he'd taken the minutes at the meeting internally and translated them into like Kevin Peterson's version of events. Yep. And he'd headed to Andy Flower's hotel room. And then a document prepared to support the ECB's legal team after he was sacked says KP, this is in the as he's in Andy Flower's room, KP stated that Alistair Cook was weak, tactically inept, and Alistair Cook's latest effort to galvanise the team was pathetic. He ranted saying that Graham Swan is a cunt, the team was shit, and having a go Andy Flower and his coaching. And he said that in order to build team spirit, Andy Flower needed to let the players go and get pissed, especially the younger players, which seems like a very specific thing after he'd been criticised for it.
Yeah.
And the whole thing just kind of dragged on for 10,000 years.
Yes.
The main thing that I remember from it is just the ECB afterwards just spending so long like propping up Alistair Cook and talking him up on what a wonderful person and what a wonderful family he had, and basically just painting this enormous target on him and hoisting him aloft like the poor guy. Like, I know, I'm sure he had like a part in it, but just in saying no, you're all wrong about him, he's amazing, just yes. everybody love Alistair Cook, and everyone's like pelting him with excrement, and that was basically how it all panned out. But yeah, just not speaking to your main player for the whole match and then immediately sacking him after the test. I mean, for a series, that's quite a big thing. But for this, obviously just nominating for this test match, that was, I think, a pretty big moment.
It was. I mean, it's the whole thing is just clearly absurd. It is very sad, but it is also very ridiculous. I think, you know, there's plenty of blame to go around on everybody, but I guess my feeling kind of as an outsider who didn't really care that much how England went or how England team politics went was that I kind of figured if you want to coach or captain an international side, part of the territory comes, you know, with having to deal with people that, you know, you may not get along with, and you still have to find some kind of way to integrate them into the team. I think it's very difficult to believe that whatever negatives KP's personality have.
I could probably go press continuous on that one.
I just don't believe that those negatives could possibly be outshining the positives of his actual skill at batting. I mean, he still scored the most runs for England in this series, despite
not trying for half the time. Yeah. Well, no, I think he's trying, but there's certainly an element of being beyond caring towards the end.
Yeah, I mean, and just as a point of comparison, I think from an Australian perspective, the most obvious comparison is about a decade or so earlier. That's when John Buchanan and Steve Waugh, who I think met pretty closely to Cook and Flower, and that they found some kind of way to coddle Shane Warne's ego sufficiently for him to continue on. And I think that's all, you know, a pretty good mapping. And I guess the major difference, of course, was that the Australian team of that era tended not to go on losing streaks.
Yeah, I think constantly winning every single series tends to keep the team spirits high, whereas the 5-0 annihilation, you know, I think there were a few sort of breaking points.
Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, in retrospect, England's big mistake was probably to lose these tests.
Yeah. And I suppose that what they were doing was that they'd lost these tests and then reached a point where they were looking ahead and thinking, well, you know, a winning team is always in good spirits. Mm. And they looked ahead and thought, well, we're probably going to carry on losing. So this situation is untenable.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess, you know, from a fan's perspective, it's a shame because, you know, KP was a very reliable provider of nonsense. He was just this magnificent strutting purveyor of absurdity, and it was cruel to take him away from us.
He still sort of managed to deliver nonsense from outside the team.
He did,
I remember
yes.
a couple of years later, where there was sort of whispers that he might, we might be able to bring him back into the team if he comes back and renounces the IPL and plays a couple of county matches. And he sort of swanned in and made about 300 in an innings. They still didn't pick him. It was amazing.
Yeah. And I did like, kind of as a finale, the KP's final dismissal was also a ridiculous moment from fellow last test player, George Bailey, who did this kind of ridiculous backwards leaping catch from short leg. That was farewell to both George Bailey and KP with that moment.
Wandering off arm in arm.
And it's also Mike Carberry's last test. And, that, you know, we've seen throughout this series that he was a player with much comic potential. So, that's a shame that he disappeared.
And a decent amount of cricket potential as well. I said that. Yeah. He was, England often did this with players where they would give somebody a go in the Ashes.
Yeah.
And away Ashes in particular. Yes. I think they did the same with Chris Reid for a few tests. And they maybe didn't, have an amazing time in this absolute crucible. And then they would sort of like cast them adrift after that because they'd failed. Whereas other players would get sort of a few good years of warming up to a big away Ashes series. And they would have a sort of longer rope afterwards. I think Carberry was treated pretty badly.
All right. Are we done with KP? Are we like Alastair Cook and Andy Flower? We're done with KP?
We're just done with him.
Yep.
We're done with him. Let's move on to some lighter moments. Yes. Maybe some things that we feel didn't make the cut.
I was kind of tickled that Michael Clarke was so close to being able to declare and set England 500 again as he did in the first three tests, but Australia carelessly were bowled out for 448, so he didn't get the opportunity to be ridiculous. So that's why that wasn't nominated.
England's collapsing is... I almost can't believe that I didn't... I always like to nominate an England collapse. And England... like when you're playing for pride,
yep,
and then you collapse to 23 for 5 in the first innings, that is an incredible sort of it's hard to take too much pride from that, isn't it?
Yes.
And then in the second innings lasted 31.4 overs, so two collapses in collapse v collapse from England. I'm slightly regretting not nominating that.
Well, I think the second innings stat I saw, which kind of tickled me, was that England lost their last 7 wickets in 64 balls after tea, but they also scored 79 runs, so they were just having a great old time.
Pretty entertaining. Broad actually made 72 off 74 balls in this match, which, when you consider that England, like in 2 innings, just about got past 300, is quite the contribution.
God bless Stuart Broad.
Oh, God bless Stuart.
I guess another minor moment which didn't quite qualify. I like the way that Brad Haddin brought up his inevitable first innings 50 this time. He defended one of Stokes' deliveries back down the pitch, and Stokes just kind of let it dribble past him, just because he was knackered. And so Haddin just took off to scamper through to get his 50 while the ball just kind of dribbled to mid on.
Raced the ball to the other end, basically.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. Just in general, I mean, this is very, very much hindsight corner, but the feeling with England in this test was basically that Ben Stokes did 90% of things and everybody else chipped in a percentage point each, which becomes more and more familiar as Ben Stokes' career continues.
As England performances go, this is one of the most ridiculous, I think. I've got even more that I could have nominated.
Yeah.
There are a couple of leaves. We had leaves in the previous match, so I didn't nominate this time, but second ball of day 2, Cook was LBW leaving. A Harris delivery that I reckon it would have hit middle halfway up. It was one of those leaves. So, yep. I mean, at least, like, unlike in the previous test, it wasn't first ball and he wasn't bowled. So, yep. Quite that bad. But then a bit later, Stokes was bowled leaving Siddle, which probably hit middle and off. So people were just very reluctant to use their cricket bats.
Well, maybe they saw Carberry's bat and thought, oh, what's the point?
Well, yeah, what's the point? It's not gonna... At least I can look after my bat. If I can't look after my stumps, I'll look after my bat. Use this again somewhere else.
Yeah.
One of my favourite moments from the match, which is not really worth a nomination, but James Anderson caught Ryan Harris in the first innings and then just volleyed the ball back at the stumps, just kicked the ball back at the stumps with such fury. It was... And I think in the was it the previous match when he went for 28 off George Bailey hit him for 28?
No, that was the third test.
Sorry, that was the third test. Yep. And he didn't really react. But I don't know if he just sort of like just poured it all inside himself, because it definitely gave the impression that by this point, whatever happened, he was just furious. He was just like trapped in perpetual fury where he even took a catch and he was just enraged about it, kicking the ball at stumps.
Yes.
And then another of my, this is my final thing I want to mention, one of my favorite moments of commentary. And I've already mentioned this to you, just to give a view behind the curtain. But I asked you, who said, I'd had in here four, and the entire commentary is just bash. That's the entire commentary. And I asked you who that was, and who was that?
And my response was, that's fucking Brayshaw. Yeah, so James Brayshaw, he's the master of onomatopoeia.
What I love most about this is that as an England fan, we don't have really very little or any exposure to James Brayshaw, but I hear about him a lot. So I have this sort of secondhand notion of what he is. And then to sort of pick out one single word of commentary and for you to react like that, it really amused me.
Yeah. Oh, very good. All right, so we're going to go to the votes now?
Yes, let's get in it. And I'm feeling pretty confident.
I'm very scared of the votes here because there's some spectacular English nonsense here, and I'm not sure anything Australia's put up can match it.
There's some really good stuff all around. I feel like my strongest nomination, and it's not the most entertaining to me, to be honest, and I actually don't really enjoy talking about it, but Kevin Peterson not being involved, falling out with everybody, your best player falling out with everybody, not speaking to anybody, and then the team saying, let's not have our best player in the team, our best batsman in the team, is...
That's world-class ridiculousness, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I don't really enjoy talking about it either, but it's got to be a three-pointer. It's right up there.
The waves of that ridiculous can still be felt now. Yes. They're not even ripples. You still sort of cascade past you every now and again during a summer.
Yep.
We never know who KP's going to be on commentary with. It's all very exciting. And then at the opposite end of the spectrum, I think Mike Carberry's bat as just a trivial, silly moment. I think that's spectacular.
You may call it a trivial, silly moment, but Mark Nicholas declared it the second most important moment of the series. So I think it's got to be right up there. So somewhere between those two is the truth, I think. And I suspect it may be closer to your analysis of the moment.
I prefer the Carberry moment greatly, but I think the KP moment's the bigger, more ridiculous one.
Yeah. And sadly, I don't think I've got anything that topped that. I think my most ridiculous moment, and again, it's really only a statistical moment. It's Nathan Lyon essentially topping the batting average for both teams. And I think that's very ridiculous. But whether it's more ridiculous, it's certainly not more ridiculous than KP or Carberry's bat, which are both just monumentally nonsensical.
I feel like I need to sort of sit for a minute and dwell on the Nathan Lyon. The stats is one. It is one of those freaky stats that cricket throws up where it's a slow burner where it snuck up on you. No point has Nathan Lyon played any kind of innings, but at no point has Nathan Lyon ever been defeated either. So he's kind of crept up on the rails there. The other big ones are the our respective team selections. I think it's pretty incredible that Australia picked the same team.
Yeah.
As you said, having Ryan Harrison alone is quite a freakish thing.
Poor old Ryan.
England's team selection, they had three debutants. And as far as we can tell, two of them played their final tests.
Yeah, well, their final test for England, right?
That's entirely true.
Yes, but in itself, that's kind of ridiculous as well. To be honest, I think all fight has been taken from me here. I think this is an innings victory for England. I'll let you have all three moments for this, because Australia have been swept away. This has been an absolute drubbing of a series.
Like I say, I regret not nominating the batting collapses in a way, which were kind of part and parcel of it all. the sort of dueling batting collapses, playing for pride and then to collapse twice in such spectacular fashion. It was really it was England's test. I feel like we should acknowledge that it was England's test.
Absolutely England's test. Australia had a lot of hope after the first test of this series, where they'd you know, won the test and won the ridiculous test as well, which is, we've seen, is a difficult thing to do. But this was from pretty much that point on, they just had no answer to England. And I think that kind of culminates here. I went through what Australia were doing ridiculous wise, and you know, I've got Steve Smith wearing a slightly too big cap. That's it.
I mean, cricketers talk about momentum all the time, and that's the story of this series, isn't it? It's England, you know, a little bit of a shaky start, losing the first test, but by this point, I mean, if this had been like the 1997 Ashes and there'd been a sixth test, I can't imagine what would have happened. I don't know who would be. I don't think they would have been able to put out an 11 for a start. I think down to 8 or 9 players. it would have been quite something to see, but I'm glad it didn't happen.
Yes, well, so congratulations to England. A 4-1 ridiculous Ashes win. Not quite the clean sweep, but next best thing, surely.
Yeah, I think I'm happy with that. I feel like they're giving a good account of themselves.
Yeah, salvage something from a series that a lot of England fans would otherwise not choose to revisit. All right. Well, thank you for listening to our coverage of the 2013-14 Ridiculous Ashes. We hope you've enjoyed it. You can check out Alex's website. That's kingcricket.co.uk. You can check out mine. I'm at liebcricket.com. Or you can follow us, or you can follow us. You can follow all three of us on Twitter. You can follow the King's tweets. That's Alex. Lieb Cricket, that's me. And if you want some, you know, hybrid blending of the two of us that deals mostly in just this sole podcast, you can also follow Ridiculous Ashes. And we will record a new series soonish. The best way for you to get that series when it drops is to subscribe to the podcast, of course, and you'll get that next series. And we don't know what it is yet, but you'll get it as soon as it comes out, and then you can avoid spoilers. So again, thank you for listening, and we will see you next series.
Silly.
Podcast Network.